Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the open rebellion in Iraq, where al-Qaeda's Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant have captured much of Ramadi and most of Fallujah, as the civil war in Syria appears to be merging with a new civil war in Iraq. An expert on Iraq, Juan Cole, a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and author of The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, joins us to discuss the bitter legacy of the Bush-Cheney war on Iraq, where last year over 8,000 Iraqis died in sectarian violence. Then we'll look into President Obama's latest appointments to the critical Wall Street Consumer Watchdog Commission that oversees how much we pay for gas and food, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. Michael Greenberger, the former director of the Division of Trading and Markets at the CFTC, joins us to discuss the more Wall Street-friendly commissioners President Obama is appointing, as well as who might succeed the head of consumer protection at the Federal Reserve, who is likely to be replaced by a more Wall Street-friendly appointment. Then finally, we will speak with media critic and reform advocate Robert McChesney, whose latest book, co-authored with John Nichols, is Dollarocracy: How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying Democracy. As this election year begins, we will discuss how unbridled campaign spending defines our politics and could signal the end of our democracy, with the growing price tag for buying a House and Senate seat up from $845,000 in 2000 to a minimum of $1.6 million in 2012. For the House, and up from $7.2 million to $10.3 million for the Senate. And joining us now is Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He's the author of Sacred Space and Holy War, The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, Napoleon's Egypt, Invading the Middle East, and Engaging the Muslim World. He's also the author of the blog Inform Comment at juancole.com. Welcome to Background Briefing, Juan Cole.
Thank you, Ian.
And is it possible that the civil war in Syria is merging with this new civil war in or revived civil war in Iraq?
Well, I think the situation in the two countries is quite different. So I wouldn't call them civil wars, but certainly it is the case that the rebellion and violence in Syria has renewed the life of the Sunni extremists in northern Iraq.
And we have to put this in the context of this bloody attrition that's been going on since the U.S. pulled out, with more than 8,000 Iraqis dying in sectarian violence last year, according to the United Nations, the bloodiest year since 2008.
Yes, this death toll is a result of the revival of the low-intensity guerrilla war in Iraq. I want to underline that it's not a civil war in Iraq, because unlike what you saw in 2006-2007, when many more people died in violence, as many as 2,000 and 3,000 a month at some points, this is not neighborhood faction fighting between two sectarian groups. The violence is being pursued by a small band of guerrilla fighters who deploy sniping and car bombing and other techniques. Many of the dead are innocent bystanders who get caught up in those attacks. And so it's a war of the guerrillas on the institutions of the nascent Shiite-dominated government of Iraq.
But apparently these al-Qaeda flags are flying over key government buildings in Fallujah, most of which apparently has been captured by the rebels, if you whatever you want to call them, and also Ramadi as well, parts of that. So that, I guess, is what's getting people's attention, the idea that the government has lost control of its own territory, or if indeed it ever had control of it.
Yes, there's there's been an increase in territory held by the guerrillas in the Sunni Arab cities of Ramadi and Fallujah and Khalidiyah. These groups have been influential in some city quarters and in some areas of some provinces for a very long time now. I mean, this insurgency is nearly 10 years old. And so that's not new. What's new is that in the last 5 years, those groups had lost the ability to take and hold territory. And now they're regaining that ability. There's been a big influx of money from places like Kuwait, from private Gulf billionaires, oil billionaires, to these groups in Syria. There's been an influx of weaponry. They've gained battlefield experience from fighting the Syrian troops. These groups operate on both sides of the border. And so I think that's how the resources that they have gained in northern Syria have spilled back over into Iraq.
Again, I'm speaking with Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He is the author of Sacred Space and Holy War, The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, Napoleon's Egypt, Invading the Middle East, and Engaging the Muslim World. He's also the author of the blog Informed Comment at juancole.com. So it looks as though, in retrospect now, the so-called surge that General Petraeus was credited with, it always seemed to me and others that I've spoken to that it was really only basically the means by which Bush and Cheney and Rice and Rumsfeld were able to save face. They didn't seem to know what to do. They, you know, triumphantly invaded the place, claiming that they were bringing democracy, and essentially handed it over to Iran. And when the insurgency caught them by surprise and intensified, they seemed to be at a total loss until this idea came up to bribe the Sunni in Anbar, the very people that seem to be now engaged in this fighting. And the rest is history, but it was always a cosmetic fig leaf behind which the U.S. could get out of the place. Is that the correct analysis?
Well, certainly the troop escalation that was ordered by Bush in late 2006 did not have the vast effects that its supporters have claimed for it. Actually, the U.S. troop levels just went back up to those that it had seen in 2005. So it wasn't a new amount of troops on the ground. It wasn't unprecedented. I think they did have an effect. There were a lot of firefights with the Sunni radicals. But I think the big thing that happened in that period of 2006-2007 is that there was a civil war. It was a war fought more or less under the noses of the U.S. troops in back alleys and neighborhoods where they didn't control things. And I think they played into it by because General Petraeus made a deal with Prime Minister al-Maliki to disarm the Sunni Arabs first and then to go after the Shiite radicals. And by doing that, I think he left the Sunni communities helpless. And at night, the Shiite, who were still armed, would go into neighborhoods and ethnically cleanse them. So Baghdad went from being 50-50 Sunni and Shiite when Bush invaded to probably being something on the order of 80% Shiite by the end of 2007. So the fighting and the deaths did get tamped down in Baghdad, but I think it was largely because if you were an angry Shiite and wanted to kill Sunnis, you would have had to get in your car and drive for a while to find any. And the Sunnis were displaced to other cities, even all the way to Syria and Jordan.
So when President Bush and Condoleezza Rice met with the Sunni tribal leaders in Anbar province in September of 2007, are those same Sunni tribal leaders the ones that are now joining al-Qaeda?
Well, some of them, Ahmed Abu Risha, for instance, the brother of Abdul Sattar Abu Risha, who led an Awakening Council or Sons of Iraq unit back in those days, are still around and they're still fighting al-Qaeda. And indeed, Abu Risha announced on Sunday that his forces had taken back 90% of Ramadi. I don't know whether that's true or not, but Abu Risha is attempting to reemerge as the kind of pro-government Sunni leader fighting the radicals that we had seen in the heyday of 2007. And I think almost certainly hoping that he can show himself valuable to the government of Nouri al-Maliki, which, after all, has billions in oil receipts to share around.
Well, Juan Cola, I guess the point of my earlier question was to try and get an idea of how much we still are culpable for this disaster in Iraq following the Bush-Cheney invasion. I recall the only voice inside that government that even spoke out with any kind of caution was Colin Powell, who used the famous pottery barn analogy, you know, if you break it, you own it. Well, we broke it. I believe there's still about 4 million displaced Iraqis outside of this country. The Christians have been driven out. The place has been in a low simmering bloodbath since we got out, and now there's open rebellion in Anbar province. It's just an ugly picture, and it looks as though we've sort of washed our hands and walked away, and suddenly it's no longer our responsibility.
That's right. Well, the United States has a long history of intervening violently in other countries and then walking away. We've seen it over and over again in places like Haiti and Honduras. So it's not really a new thing. It's the scale of it in Iraq is unusual. It's a big country. It's an important country. It's an oil country. But certainly the Bush administration is responsible for destabilizing the northern reaches of the Persian Gulf for probably decades to come. And I think they were going for a greater stability, a greater possibilities of pumping oil, removing sanctions on that had been put on the Saddam Hussein regime. And all of those plans have crashed and burned. Oil is still up near $100 a barrel. All these years later, we were promised $14 a barrel oil by Rupert Murdoch. The incompetence and sometimes maliciousness of the Bush administration rule of Iraq has left it a basket case. So I think we can, you know, historians don't have many prerogatives in life, Ian, but I think we can pronounce the Bush endeavor in Iraq an enormous failure, perhaps the greatest in American foreign policy.
But it still appears to have had the ironic blowback, if you will, that the U.S. has spent all these lives and treasures, and of course most of the casualties, the preponderance of casualties were Iraqis who died, and we don't quite know what the full figure is of how many Iraqis died. But the U.S. it costs what $3 trillion or something. We're not sure about that. But at the end of the day, we haven't been able to. The U.S. hasn't been able to persuade Maliki to stop the Iranians from flying arms and money into Syria. And apparently just recently, the Iraqi government, Maliki's government, halted secret U.S. Surveillance drone flights over the country. So it seems pretty clear whose side he's on. Well, he's certainly not on our side.
Well, it was foreseeable that the Shiite Iraqis would ally with the Iranian Shiites were they to take over Iraq. And so that's what's happened, actually. Nouri al-Maliki initially had indifferent relations with Iran, but as he has faced these problems of the extremist Sunni rebellion in Syria, the resurgence of Sunni extremism in northern Iraq, he has gravitated closer and closer to Iran. He also gets electricity and refined petroleum from Iran. 70% of Iran's goods getting around the U.S. sanctions on Iran now are sold to Iraq. So Iran has benefited. The Shiites of Iraq have benefited. But the security situation in Iraq has been left extremely fragile. I don't anticipate, by the way, that the government will have difficulty in taking back those towns if it puts its mind to it. It does have an army. It has deployed it successfully in Basra and elsewhere. It has helicopter gunships from the Americans. I was in Iraq last May, Ian, and I was struck by how bizarre it is, really, that the Iraqi new army wears American-style uniforms and has American weaponry. It has American tanks and armored cars and planes and so forth. So it's really a little bit surreal to watch the Iraqis deploy this military equipment. They look, you know, if you don't look closely, they look like it's an American army. So I think the army that's loyal to Nur al-Maliki will prevail in this particular fight, but the likelihood of Sunni discontents going away is low. And al-Maliki has been very bad politically about reaching out to the Sunnis, which is one of the reasons that he's having this current crisis.
And my understanding is that although there are U.S. advisors there in the vast embassy compound in Baghdad, they're not active, are they not? If they can't fly drones, it would indicate that they're not active, right?
Well, I went to the embassy. I went into the green zone when I was there in May, and I was told by the embassy staff that there's a very rapid withdrawal of personnel. I think they were expecting to be down to 5,000 or so by this time. Only a couple hundred of those are diplomats, and the rest are security people, many of them contractors. So I think that they're mainly concerned with gathering intelligence in the region and protecting the Green Zone. I very much doubt that they're in a position to help al-Maliki in any material way, except that they're giving him more weaponry. But as I said, the Iraqi army that's been created in the past few years isn't so bad. It seems actually to be able to mount operations, to take territory, to stand and fight, and they proved this as early as 2008 in Basra. So I don't worry so much about a Syria kind of situation where, you know, parts of the country go permanently out of government hands. I would be surprised if that happened. But I do think that, you know, what's going on here is that city quarters are being taken over by al-Qaeda in part because they want to be. They hate the government. They hate al-Maliki. You know, it's not much reported in our press anymore, but al-Maliki sent a SWAT team into al-Anbar province to arrest a sitting member of parliament who was a Sunni last weekend. And they dragged him off in chains, and there was a firefight at his compound, and they killed his brother. And this is a member of parliament. So 44 Sunni members of parliament submitted their resignation. You know, the government is in danger of collapsing over this kind of thing. And al-Maliki, just is like a bull in a china shop. He has no finesse. He's very unnuanced in his approach to things.
Putting it politely. Well, Juan Cole, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me in.
Again, I've been speaking with Juan Cole. He's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He's the author of Sacred Space and Holy War, The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, Napoleon's Egypt Invading the Middle East, and Engaging the Muslim World. He's also the author of the blog InformComment at JuanCole.com. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about Obama's Wall Street-friendly appointments to the Commodity Futures Trading Commission.